Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. Homelessness is something that affects people in every part of our state. In Albuquerque alone, about 5,000 households will experience homelessness in the space of a year. Today, we're going to be talking about potential solutions to this problem. We'll talk about the importance of emergency shelters, housing, education, and even community. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you or someone you care about experienced homelessness? Are you currently experiencing homelessness? What do you think local governments and nonprofits can do to help people get back into a stable housing situation? Call 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. Tracy Sharp Weaver is with us today. She is the executive director of Saranam, a program that helps people experiencing homelessness get transitional housing and education in addition to other services. Tracy, can you tell us about what your program offers?
Well, Saranam is a two-year program for families experiencing homelessness where we will provide everything they need to live, including a fully furnished apartment, while the adults go to school full-time to increase their earning opportunities through education. It's a two-generational program, so we are also working on building life skills in both the adults and the children so that they can sustain the changes that they're making in the long term.
Okay, and how is that different than the kind of services that people would get at, say, a shelter or something like that?
Well, we have a really focused program that works side by side with our families, enabling them to make the changes in their lives longitudinally. So we're working for 2 years with them on education and building the skills. And so they're actually doing a lot of work. It's their full-time job to be a full-time student and a full-time parent.
Now, your program emphasizes both housing and education, but also a sense of community. Can you tell us why that's important to folks who are transitioning from homelessness?
Well, we found that when families end up homeless, they have really lost the resources of people in their lives. They have lost the networks. They've lost that support system. And so we really are intentional about building that into every aspect, including the way that we are set up. So we bring in a cohort of families, one group of families each fall to coincide with the beginning of school that allows our kids to be in one classroom for a full school year, sometimes for the first time in their life. And that builds their friendships, that builds their relationships. It also allows our adult families to be in our on-site classes and, again, build those healthy relationships, learning how to live in community together. Having that support system rebuilt in their lives is really important in their transition out of homelessness and out of poverty. If we think about the ways that we are connected to each other, those are the really important relationships that help move ourselves forward. And the same is so for the families in our program.
So are a lot of people in your program able to find permanent housing afterwards?
Absolutely. Our families kind of range in where they're housed and how they get housed on exit because they each have their own individual journey in their path. We have some who have actually purchased their own homes either right at exit or a couple of years after they've exited our program because they have a stable employment and stable housing as they leave. And that stability, housing stability, employment stability are really important in the long-term outcome. A lot of our families do move into rentals and those things that they are providing for themselves through their employment or through their scholarships as they continue their education as they leave. And so we kind of had that broad spectrum.
So education is really important to the program as well. How many people go on to get their degrees afterwards?
Most of our families complete some sort of significant educational hallmark. Sometimes that's a GED. Sometimes that's a vocational certificate. Sometimes those are several associate's degrees, or sometimes those are bachelor's. And a lot of times our families continue in their educational path once they leave our program. So, for instance, we had a woman last year that graduated with two associate's degrees in her first year of our program, and she continued, or as she was exiting our program, she got a job at another local nonprofit as a caseworker and is continuing at Highlands University in her social work degree.
And do you remember any other clients you worked with who really got a lot out of the program?
Oh, I could tell you many stories. We have a woman who worked her way through her nursing school, and she graduated from nursing school, got her license, and is working in the NICU at UNMH. We have another woman who worked her way through a sonography and diagnostician program at CNM and was doing very well after she left working in a hospital. We have another woman who was a refugee from Cuba, and she and her son came here escaping domestic violence. None of her licenses as a nurse, a head nurse at a facility in Cuba, transferred. And so she started from scratch and became a phlebotomist as well as a medical translator. And those have worked, had worked her really well in her life. That's our family who she actually saved enough money to purchase her home before she left Suriname. And she and her son live in Rio Rancho and have a backyard with a dog now.
So if you could grow the program, what would you add?
We are planning on growing the program, not only to double our capacity in the next 2 years with a second site, but we are adding an aftercare component right now. In fact, we have a listed posting for that position right now. It'll be a caseworker who works with families after they exit the program to help continue to provide resources, a listening ear, to follow those children to make sure that they are on the right path, and to help really us evaluate what we do really well and what we could do better for our families, what they got the most out of, and to tie that back in. So we are not only planning on building our capacity and building different programming aspects, but we are also embarking on a capital campaign to double the capacity of our families we can serve.
Great.
So up to 50 families in the next few years.
Okay. Do you work or volunteer providing services to people who are experiencing housing insecurity? What advice do you have for long-term solutions to homelessness? Give us a call, 277-5866, or tweet using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Now I'd like to welcome Tatiana Williams. She is a student at the University of New Mexico. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi.
Can you tell us about what you're studying and how that's going?
I am studying political science. I will graduate in spring of 2020.
And you have some really exciting news that you just told us about this morning. Tell us what that's about.
Yes, I was invited to a dinner at the White House.
Amazing.
Next week, so I will be attending.
What is that for? What's the dinner for?
It is for African American Month.
Fantastic. Now, before you were a student, you were kind of having a rough time. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I was homeless for about 3 years off and on.
Okay. And what kind of challenges did you face during that time?
My biggest challenge, I think, was keeping a job.
Mm-hmm. What was difficult about that?
Just being homeless, not knowing, you know, where I'm going to sleep the next night, how I'm going to get my kids dressed, how I'll get dressed and make it to work.
Right. And during that time, what do you think helped you the most?
Gosh. The community and just looking at my kids and even watching other girls in the shelters, you know, transition out, gave me a little hope that I would.
And were there employers who helped you out?
Yes. I had a lot of advocates and people who helped me, like, apply for jobs and connect with jobs that they know, work with single parents that are dealing with homelessness, so.
And, you know, after going through this experience, what kind of misperceptions do you think people have about you and people who've had similar experiences?
I think they feel that people become homeless because they are lazy or not doing anything with their lives, and that's not true.
What did you find among people in the same kind of situation?
People become homeless for many different reasons. It could be a fire at their house, a domestic violence that they're fleeing with their children, just many.
And you had children, of course, at that time.
Yes.
What kind of experiences, what kind of challenges did you face with having children?
Childcare and transportation.
Yeah. So what do you think most people don't understand about the experience of being homeless?
I think there is a lack of resources for the homeless community, and it's very hard to come out of homelessness. It's not easy.
So how did you do that?
I entered into Suriname.
Okay, so tell me how you became a part of that program, and then what was it like for you?
I got connected to Suriname through a different organization, and I loved being in Suriname. It was challenging because they give you the resources, but you have to do the work. You have to want to be successful. And
what kind of work did you do as part of that program? Like, what were the most difficult things?
I did not have my GED when I entered into the program. So going to school for my GED and taking classes was difficult for me because I did both right away. Most people get their GED and then they take their classes, but I did both at the same time. So that was a challenge for me.
And did you find that the community at Suriname was able to help you with that?
Yes, they offered tutors anytime we needed them. We have teachers that would help us if we needed them. So it was very helpful.
And what would you tell folks who are facing the kind of situation that you went through?
I would say just keep going. Utilize your resources. And just don't give up. Just keep going.
Well, thank you so much. Okay, well, now I'd like to welcome Lori Frappier, the Executive Director of the New Mexico...
Director of Development.
I'm sorry, the Director of Development of the New Mexico Supporting Housing Coalition. Now, Lori, your program uses what's called the Housing First model.
Correct.
And that prioritizes putting people into long-term housing before helping them get jobs and treatment for addiction or other mental health services. Why do you believe it is so important for people to get housing before they get a job or services?
So Housing First is really a national model. It's an evidence-based model that shows that when people are feeling safe and secure in their environment, that they're more likely to get the help that they need to maintain housing stability. Now, Supportive Housing Coalition really deals with a different demographic than Suriname, in that we're dealing with people with behavioral health disabilities, mental health disabilities, highly vulnerable, difficult to manage illnesses that could potentially be life-threatening, right? So we have to make sure that we get them into safety first, and that's what Housing First does. And I wouldn't say that, you know, a lot of times those housing and services will happen simultaneously. So it's not necessarily one then the other. But we do believe that once we get them into a safe place, then they're more likely to access those services. One of the main principles of Housing First is the whole idea of there goes my memory.
Oh, that's quite all right.
of choice, right? And,
okay.
And personal choice. And we believe highly that we can't force anybody to choose services. But if we can get them to a place where they can trust us, and they're more likely to enter into that.
So how do you go about getting people into that kind of trusting space?
We at Supportive Housing, we have service coordinators, and they help our clients to connect with services. So sometimes it might mean simply getting them access to economic services like VA disability or SSI or SSDI, so that they can start having an income. Because a lot of people that are coming in off the street don't realize that they even have those benefits. So when we get people money, they're like, oh, you know, that's really helpful. Really just being able to offer them choices is really can help establish trust rather than us telling them what it is, you know. And when we start looking at their ability to maintain housing, we ask questions like, what do you want? What do you want in the long term? And really start making it person-centered and not system-centered, because it's kind of arrogant, right, for us to tell people this is what you have to do and this is what you need, you know, and really coming at a point where it becomes them.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about ideas to end homelessness. What do you think the government should do to help people who are experiencing homelessness? Are city and county leaders doing enough to address this issue? What about state agencies? Our number is 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. We are also live tweeting the show, so send us your comments using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're going to take a quick break.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at RothsteinLaw.com. Support comes from the New Mexico Philharmonic. World-renowned pianist Olga Kern returns to Popejoy Hall, 6 p.m., Saturday the 23rd, playing the Rakh 3, Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto. Reserved seat tickets at nmphil.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Linda Graham, author of Resilience. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about powerful practices for bouncing back from disappointment, difficulty, and even disaster.
Saturday mornings at 6 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about homelessness today, and we're taking your calls. Have you or someone you cared about ever experienced homelessness? What surprised you or was unexpected about that time in your life? Where did you get help? We want to hear from you. Call 277-5866, and that's in the 505 area code. I'm talking to Lori Frappier, the Development Director of the Supportive Housing Coalition. Lori, can you tell me about one of your clients who was really able to benefit from the Housing First model and your program?
Absolutely. So we had one client, her name was Anna, and she was, she always told us, you know, I had it all. I had the house, I had the cars, I had everything. And then it became a series of really bad economic events. They got laid, you know, her and her partner got laid off from their jobs. They started having to not pay their mortgage. They had to start foreclosing, and losing their cars and that type of thing. So they were living out of her car for a while, and then that broke down. So then she was on the streets, and she went through probably the worst thing that a woman could experience out on the streets. She got raped. She got assaulted. She got, you know, and to hear her talk now, it's really incredible, because once we were able to get her housed in a safe place, she said that we basically saved her life. What's interesting about Anna is that her and her partner eventually incomed out of our program, because once they were able to get stable and back on their feet, they were able to go back and get jobs. And she did have behavioral health issues and that type of thing. So she was a rare client for us, and that she was able to reestablish herself to maybe not quite where she was before, but definitely on the road to getting there. So she has definitely, and they have actually exited our program, and they've moved on to what we call Section 8 housing.
Do you find that a lot of the folks that you work with are close to, like they have come from a stable situation, and it was just a series of unforeseen events that led them to be in this kind of situation?
Well, like Tatiana was saying, is, you know, everybody has a different story. So that would be one story, you know. Okay. For some people, it's really severe mental health issues where they didn't realize that what they were doing was self-destructive. And, all of a sudden they're not showing up to work, and they're not, able to relate to people, or, you know, heavy paranoia is getting in the way of them being able to hold down jobs. So, you know, maybe they never entered the workforce because of that. So they had abusive life situations. It could be many, you know, one of many things that made them. But it's definitely, I hear that a lot. You know, I had a job, I had an apartment, I lost everything. I couch surfed for a while. People got tired of me. I had to go living on the streets. I have to go in shelters, that type of thing.
Now, Tracy, is this something that you've also found to be the case in your work through Serenom?
Absolutely. Everybody's story is so different from each other that, you know, people either are growing up in real poverty and homelessness, or they have situational things that happen to them, the domestic violence or the loss of a job or those kinds of things. But everyone's story is different and everyone's path is different.
I see. And so, Tracy, how do people go about getting involved in the a Housing First kind of program like this?
So we... Am I on?
Okay, so we are
we are part of a big collaboration, you know. So we have, and for us, we take referrals from a lot of different service partners. So we work with people who are on the front lines of that behavioral health work, HopeWorks, Healthcare for the Homeless, Heading Home, Therapeutic Living Services. So all those people, you know, we're involved in a big collaboration so that we can get outreach to people who are living in shelters or living on the streets or in other programs. And so they go through what they call an intake process, and they are actually scored on a vulnerability index so that once they're entered into the system, so to speak, it's called a coordinated entry system, and the Coalition to End Homelessness can talk more about that. But we get referrals from that system. And so the idea is that it's not a waiting list that's first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. It's about who's the most vulnerable at this particular moment in time. And as soon as we have an opening for one of our housing programs, we can get them into those slots. So,
now, Tatiana, when you were experiencing homelessness, did you use any shelters or anything like that prior to getting involved in Serenom?
Yes, I think I've been to every shelter in Albuquerque, unfortunately.
Can you tell me about the difference in the experiences of going to a shelter versus working in a more stable housing environment like Serenom?
Well, in a shelter, you have a time limit. And once that time limit is up, you either can hope to get into a new shelter or you are back out on the streets. And in Serenom, you get to stay for 2 years. You know your spot is secured and that you'll be okay. And you won't have to worry about, you know, am I going to be homeless tomorrow? Or
have you ever lost your house or your apartment? Or maybe you came really, really close to losing your home. What happened? How did you get through that time? What did you learn? Call 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. Now we have Lisa Uval. She's the Deputy Director of Housing and Homelessness Services for the City of Albuquerque. She's on the phone with us. Mayor Keller announced yesterday that the city is partnering with the University of New Mexico and UNM Hospital to expand and coordinate efforts to address homelessness. Lori, are you there? I'm sorry, Lisa.
Hi there. Yes, this is Lisa. Thank you for having me on the call.
Certainly. So can you tell me about this partnership between the city and UNM and what that will look like?
Yes, definitely. You know, this partnership really reflects the recognition from Mayor Keller, as well as the folks at UNM, that homelessness is one of the most serious issues facing our community right now, and that a piecemeal approach is not going to do it. We really have to work together as a community to have an impact on homelessness. So what the press conference yesterday was really just reflecting a really high-level commitment to work together to develop and implement what we know will be high-impact strategies for addressing homelessness in our community.
Now, how are you looking at expanding access to healthcare services for people who are experiencing homelessness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a couple different pieces to that. And one of the things that Mayor Keller recognized immediately when he came into office was that there are not enough emergency shelter beds for people in our community experiencing homelessness. So at any given night, people are sleeping outside or in their cars, other unsafe places, because they can't get into an emergency shelter because they're full. So one of the things we are committed to doing is keeping what used to be our winter shelter open year-round. So in the past, this shelter ran from mid-November to mid-March, it was large enough so that during those months, anyone who wanted a shelter bed could stay out there. But then once it closed in mid-March, folks were back on the street. So we are committed to keeping that open year-round. But it is located, that facility is located about 20 miles from downtown Albuquerque. So it's not an ideal situation. And when folks there need the ambulance, it can take a while for an ambulance to get out there. So one of the things we're talking with UNMH about is providing some basic on-site medical services at the shelter so that folks can get the medical care that they need while they're there, and hopefully that will also reduce the amount of 911 calls as well.
And what about psychiatric care? Will this partnership expand access for people who are struggling to find and keep housing?
Yeah, so yes, we're hoping that this that part of that basic care at the shelter could include just some basic behavioral health care. We're also in conversations with Bernalillo County because they are obviously a huge leader in our community around behavioral health right now with the behavioral health tax dollars that they have. We're also talking with them about how can we get some basic behavioral health, some basic behavioral health care services out there as well.
Now, Mayor Keller has prioritized addressing homelessness during his first term. The former mayor, Richard Berry, also made some high-profile efforts in this area. How is the Keller administration doing things differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, I want to stress, I think this administration is building off what we know works in our community, and that includes what Mayor Berry had done under his leadership and efforts before that as well. So there's a couple pieces. I think one piece that's new for kind of a new priority for this administration that we haven't seen in the past is really trying to increase the number of emergency shelter beds that are available for folks experiencing homelessness. And not just increasing the number of beds so that folks have a place to sleep, but really thinking about how do we build an emergency shelter system that serves as a central place for helping folks connect to long-term housing and the services they need to keep that housing. So keeping the winter shelter open year-round is really a short-term strategy. The long-term plan is we do want to build a new shelter here in town, located, not 20 miles outside of town, but in town, that provides a safe and dignified place for people to stay and that provides the resources and support that folks need to exit that shelter as soon as possible and get into permanent housing, because this is definitely about getting folks into permanent housing. The other piece of Mayor Keller's strategy is we want to increase the number of housing vouchers that are available for people experiencing homelessness. And this gets right at what the other panelists are saying. We know that the solution to homelessness is housing. Folks need housing. The reason they're homeless is they don't have housing. And in order to really make a dent on homelessness in our community, we need to know that our people need more options. So we also want to increase the amount of housing vouchers that are available for people experiencing homelessness. And we have lots of data from all the wonderful programs that are already in our community that show how effective housing is using a housing-first approach. So we're really building off of what we know works in our community.
Now, what about the communities where you locate these facilities? Often neighbors might show support for the idea, but just not in their neighborhoods. Can you talk about how you might address this tension?
Yeah, I mean, we do not have a site identified for a shelter. We will work with communities to select a site and work with them to mitigate their concerns. I do want to say I think we're lucky in that we do have several emergency shelters in our community that actually have very good relationships with their neighbors. So we can look to local models for how to do this in a way where neighbors are accept the shelter in their area and not only accept it, but often are actually very supportive. So I think we have to just really involve neighbors from the beginning as a shelter site is identified and as the shelter is designed, get input, identify specific things that we can do to mitigate concerns. I think one example is one local shelter that we have. One of the neighborhood's concerns was concerns about you know, 100 folks walking through their neighborhood every day to get to the shelter, and then walking back through the neighborhood in the morning to get to services and jobs. And so they just reached an agreement with the neighborhood that they would provide transportation from certain points in town to the shelter so that folks wouldn't have to walk through the neighborhood. And that mitigated a lot of the concern. So I think we can identify really specific things like that that we can do to make this work.
And how do you go about getting the resources and support for these projects?
Yeah, so that we're pursuing several different strategies. For building a new shelter, we are working with the state legislature right now. We're trying to secure $28 million in state capital outlay funding to plan and design and build a new shelter. And that's just kind of ongoing right now. It's during the legislative session, we'll have a better sense of where we are with that request within the next month. The mayor has also asked for $7 million in general obligation bond funds as part of his capital improvement package. And that's before council right now, so they're considering that as they look at that legislation. And then if council keeps that in there, voters will have an opportunity to approve $7 million in GO bond funds for a new shelter this fall. In terms of the housing vouchers, you know, that will also need to be a multi-pronged strategy. The vouchers, the cost to build a shelter is one-time money. The cost for vouchers is an ongoing cost, so, you know, that's always more challenging to find those reoccurring funds. We have established a One Albuquerque Housing Fund, which is an opportunity for individuals and businesses in our community who would like to help pay for a housing voucher to contribute. And folks can check that out by going to cabq.gov/family. And that's my department's website. And if you go there, you'll see the link for the One Albuquerque Housing Fund. And then, you know, we also over the next year are going to be looking at our own department budget and asking where is there room and space for us to fund new housing vouchers, because we know that's critical.
Have you or someone you cared about ever experienced homelessness? What surprised you or was unexpected about that time in your life? Where did you turn to get help? We want to hear from you. Call 277-5866, and that's in the 505 area code. Now, Lori, after hearing what Lisa has to say about the new projects being launched, what do you think about those? Do you see that these kinds of projects are going to help solve the problems that we see in the city?
One of the things that we've learned is that there's so many reasons people experience homelessness, that there's going to be a lot of access points in order to be able to serve the people that are experiencing homelessness. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have an opportunity to find the people that need those services, right? So where are we going to get those? Through shelters, through outreach. And I love that. I love it as long as, like Lisa was saying, it becomes a pathway to permanent housing, because we know that that's what's ultimately going to end homelessness for these people once and for all.
Okay. I have an email comment from Karen. She says, every homeless person has their own story. They may sound unbelievable, but she asks folks to suspend their disbelief and understand that people would change their own circumstances if they could. She would like to see services that allow people to keep their companion animals with them, or places where folks can get support if they are living in their cars and can't or don't want to stay in shelters. She also points out the long delays for people waiting for disability claims to be processed. She waited 2 years with serious health problems. So, Tracy, do you find that people in Suriname often have companion animals, and is that something you guys work with?
You know, no one in our program has companion animals. We actually do not allow pets unless they are, the certified assistance animals. Mm-hmm. And if that is the case, then that would actually absolutely be allowed. And part of our reasoning for that is our families are focusing on their education, and there is no income for them while they are in our program besides what we're providing for that. And that is a very difficult decision. We have had people who have, given their cats or their dogs to their sisters or their friends while they come in and change their lives. And then they take them back when they are able to provide for themselves their own home. Mm-hmm. And it is a very difficult kind of situation. And the disability weight is also, just to kind of respond to her, is also very challenging for people who that is, they're just waiting in line, and then they get back pay and they have a check that they needed 2 years ago.
Thanks for joining us today for Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We are talking about homelessness in New Mexico and what can be done to address it and get people home. We will be back in a minute.
America's racial history is with us every day, but who invented the very idea of distinct human races and why? We'll tell that story with names and dates.
And if we know how we made it, we have a better opportunity to deconstruct, to unmake.
Listen for our documentary special, The Invention of Race.
Sunday morning at 11 on KUNM.
This week in This American Life, a well-respected surgeon, 96 years old, has a secret that he wants the world to know. And so before he dies, he leaves a voicemail.
I have some information perhaps you might like to hear. Hanging up now. Bye.
People tossing words out into the world carelessly, and they ignite and burn for years this week.
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. Do you have a resource to share that could help folks who are experiencing housing insecurity? Or how can we step up and help out? We want to hear from you today. Give us a call at 277-5866 or tweet using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And now I have a call from Virginia in Albuquerque. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Well, I just wanted to inform everyone that to be homeless is to be despised. You are constantly verbally assaulted. People are so disrespectful to you. And I was homeless for about 7 years, and I came to the conclusion that poverty is considered a sin in this country.
Now, what do you think people can do to change that perception?
Well, I think, first of all, there should be a law making crimes against homeless people a hate crime. And they're a vulnerable group. They should be recognized as a vulnerable group.
Now, I understand that there is actually a measure before lawmakers this year that's actually addressing that very issue. Lori, could you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't know much about it. I just know that it's there.
Now, Tatiana, do you find that what Virginia is saying matches your own experience?
Yes.
Okay. And what do you think people should do to change how they treat people who are experiencing homelessness?
I think people should educate themselves on homelessness and why people become homeless, and even the resources that are available. And they also need to look at the lawmakers that they're, voting in. Are they helping the homeless community? I think all of that matters.
Okay, well, let's go now to Hank Hughes. He is the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. Hi, Hank.
Good morning.
Now, Hank, often we think of homelessness as a problem that affects those in, big cities, but there are people all over the state who are experiencing homelessness. How does your organization work to address people's needs in these communities?
Yeah, so, well, we're a statewide coalition, as you mentioned. We've been trying to make housing for homeless people and other services available in as many communities in New Mexico as possible. And so, we manage a federal grant called the Continuum of Care, and every year we have a chance to expand the services that are provided through that grant. So, for example, we just learned that we were awarded a program for Gallup that would be permanent supportive housing. And Gallup, is a place where there's a lot of homeless people and not very many services. So we're really pleased to be able to expand the permanent supportive housing in the Gallup area.
How is housing insecurity different in different parts of the state? Like, what would people in Gallup experience that is different than, say, Albuquerque or Santa Fe?
Well, I think in a way, maybe it's not that different. I mean, there's the climate can be different. And, of course, in our state, it's much warmer in Las Cruces than in the north here. And so people experience winter in a much different way. It's much more important to get inside if you are homeless in the northern part of the state. I think that there are places in New Mexico where there just are no services. And so to be homeless in those areas really means you need to get yourself somewhere where there are services. And so I think that's why Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Las Cruces probably have more homeless people than, you know, than were made homeless right in those places, because we're serving the surrounding rural areas where there are no services.
Now, do you find that there are differences in the, like, different demographics of people that you reach out to in more rural areas, like, say, older versus younger folks? Is there a better way to reach older folks versus younger folks?
You know, I don't think that we see that much of a difference. I think one of the things we've noticed is that Native Americans are overrepresented in the homeless population. I think, you know, that's not necessarily surprising, because so many Native American families are in poverty already. It's not surprising that a number of them end up homeless. I think what might be slightly different is that they're probably more likely to be homeless in Albuquerque or Santa Fe than where they came from. Native American families have a tradition of taking people in. So on the Navajo reservation, for example, overcrowding is much more common than people sleeping outside.
So now the NMCEH has a new program that you guys are getting ready to launch that's designed to help young people who are experiencing homelessness in northern New Mexico. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. Yeah, so we were very fortunate to be one of 11 communities awarded the Youth Homeless Demonstration Program, and that was for 14 counties in northern New Mexico, basically everything north of Albuquerque, pretty much. And that's a $3.37 million grant that will help us expand housing services and navigation services for homeless youth up to age 24. There's no lower limit on it. People often ask that, but, you know, as people are younger, they're more often going to be with their parents or in foster care. So it's really probably targeting people who are 15 to 24.
Now, how are the needs of rural youth different than those of other populations?
Well, I mean, like I said before, in the rural areas, there are fewer services. So lots of times people migrate to a city to get help. Doubling up is common everywhere in New Mexico. You know, the first step for someone who's lost their housing is usually to stay with another family member or a friend. It's when that doesn't work out or they have no family left willing to take them in that people become homeless, and literally homeless.
Okay. And I actually have a follow-up now on the hate crime law in New Mexico. That would be House Bill 122, and it would amend the Hate Crimes Act to add homelessness and economically disadvantaged status to the list of actual or perceived characteristics that are the basis for an intention to commit a crime motivated by hate. Tatiana, do you think that sounds like something that we should pursue?
Yes.
Okay. I'm wondering if anyone else on the panel has a thought on that bill?
We absolutely support it. You know, we know, I think one of the misconceptions is that people experiencing homelessness are the perpetrators of crime. In reality, they're more likely to be victims of crime, and it's due based primarily because they are on the street.
And I know that oftentimes homeless people are more likely to be incarcerated. Do you have specific parts of your programs that are designed to assist people who are coming out of jail or something like that?
We have one program. We work with the county and city of Albuquerque with what we call a fast track program. It's for people that are coming out of incarceration, and it's the same kind of model. We use Housing First. We you know, get them into housing right away to get them on the road to success.
Okay. And Lisa, are you still there? Hi,
yes,
Lisa.
I am.
So we were just discussing incarceration among the homeless community, and we're wondering if the city has any plans to add a component of outreach for people coming out of prison or jail.
Yeah, I think this is a good question. I mean, we know that a lot of people experiencing homelessness and or with serious behavioral health issues often end up in jail because of kind of lack of other of appropriate places for them to go. We do see building this a new shelter in town that's centrally located with lots of resources on site as being part of that broader strategy of helping folks that are cycling through jail as well as other kind of emergency institutions like detox and emergency rooms as a really critical strategy. Like, folks need a place to go, and the shelter will help provide that. We also know that many folks will not go to a shelter, and I think Lori alluded to that in her comments. You know, we can build the nicest shelter, and it can be in a central location, and there's folks that still won't go there. And those folks are also folks that are at high risk of ending up in jail because they're just doing things that they need to do to survive on the streets that can become crimes. So part of our strategy, too, within the city is to really step up our outreach, our street outreach to folks experiencing homelessness. We really want to help build a system where we're doing that in a much more coordinated way, and we really make sure that we're getting to everyone who's out there who's disconnected from services, that we know who's working with who, and that there's a real plan. Again, it's all about housing. Like, there's a real plan for moving, helping folks access housing. And so that's how we're hoping to address that issue that has to do with the jails.
Now, Lisa, before you took your position with the city, you were the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. How is your work for the city of Albuquerque informed by that previous work?
I was actually the associate director at the Coalition to End Homelessness. I worked under Hank, who's the executive director. So good to hear your voice, Hank. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about working at the coalition is it is a coalition. It's made up of organizations that provide housing and services to people experiencing homelessness. So we, as a staff member of the coalition, we were always hearing directly from those folks that were on the ground doing this very hard work of helping folks move into housing and stay housed. So I think just that perspective and that strong connection with our nonprofit partners in the community is really helping with my work here. Because really, the city has a role to play as a major funder, as an entity, an institution that can help drive change. But it's really our nonprofit partners on the ground who are actually doing the work of housing people. And so we need to be working closely together and really respecting the roles that each group of stakeholders plays. And I think that I'm able to do that because of my long experience with the coalition.
And I have an email comment from Dennis Plummer, the CEO of Heading Home. Going back to our earlier comments about companion animals, he says the West Side Shelter accepts families, women, and men, and the Albuquerque Opportunity Center, which serves men, both allow pets to accompany people. So that's something to note. Now, I'd like to take a call from Barbara in Albuquerque, who has some comments about working with homeless camps. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. So I was one of the people who worked with the camps that the former mayor was chasing around all over town. And it was a learning experience, and a lot of people in that particular group were interested in practicing autonomy over their environment as they lived there and had sets of rules and other kinds of things that went unacknowledged. And I just wanted to echo that the homeless are not the people who are out in our community murdering and prostituting their children. These are not the people who we are afraid. I mean, you know, this criminalizing and terrorizing us about having the homeless in our community and how dangerous it is just ridiculous. But what I really wanted to talk about is the West Side Shelter. I have visited that shelter, and one of those really cold nights earlier this year, there was a man by the freeway, and I stopped and I said, my gosh, do you know you can go to the West Side Shelter? And he said, there's no dignity there. And I just want to say that, you know, the beds out there, it's a giant kind of dormitory warehouse full of beds, and you can keep your stuff there during the day when you're not allowed to be there and come back to your same bed at night. But you're also sleeping in a room with everyone else who's coughing, snoring, having bad dreams, maybe having a mental health issue, all of that kind of stuff. And there really is, yes, it is a place to stay warm and safe overnight, which are two huge issues. The homeless vulnerability in our community, we've seen these people kicked in the head. We've seen them, you know, in hospitals for months after having their heads stomped on downtown. And these are not people who are being attacked by the homeless. But regardless, we don't really have a good solution that does provide a level of dignity for people who are on the streets for whatever reason. And, you know, these people are all individuals, as has already been said, with their own issues. And, you know, dignity is something that people would like to have. And, you know, these kind of solutions really are not great.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I'd like to throw that question to Lisa and see, Lisa, how do you address the issue of dignity in emergency shelters?
Yeah, I really appreciate Barbara's comments, and I always say, you know, we need to give people as a safe and dignified place to stay that's a path to permanent housing. And I agree, the West Side Shelter is not ideal. Folks may know it used to be an old jail, and it was just repurposed as an emergency shelter many, many years ago before my time. It is set up, except families can have more private spaces, but for single men and women, it's very large, kind of dormitory style. It's not ideal, but it was the thing that we could do very quickly to increase access to emergency shelter. You know, we looked at all of our options, and we thought the quickest way to do this in the short term is to keep that shelter open year-round. But in the long term, when we build a new shelter that's located here in town, the idea, we would want to design it very differently than how the West Side Shelter looks, and design it in a way where it does provide more dignity for folks experiencing homelessness.
Okay, and Tatiana, as someone who has experienced homelessness, how do you think that people in everyday walks of life can increase their compassion for people who are experiencing that and treat them with more dignity?
I would say just be kind, ask them, you know, if they know of their resources, can I help you look for a place to go? Gosh, I can name 100 things.
Okay. What about your experience in the shelters? Were there some that you found were better than others?
Yes, I actually spent one night at Joy Junction, and me and my children were in a room with just everyone, and it was terrifying. I didn't sleep. The next day, I just said, I'm not staying here. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel safe. It was not the place for me and my kids to take shelter. So I understand what the caller was saying.
Okay, well, that is all the time we have today. Thank you so much to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our panelists today. And the conversation does not have to end here. You can share your thoughts by commenting on KUNM.org or email us at letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Next week, we'll be talking about rural libraries and the critical role they play in communities around New Mexico. I am Ty Bannerman. Our engineer is Marina Spencer. Kaveh Movahed screened our calls, and Celia Rainey live-tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. Thanks to my grandmother for tuning in. This is Let's Talk New Mexico at 89.9 KUNM.